everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer, and I am one half of Wannabe Games, a maker of tabletop role-playing games, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hello, I am Craig Campbell. I am the owner of Nerdburger Games, and I make a whole bunch of games for that, and I've freelanced for some other people and all that sort of thing, too. I was going to try to freelance my way into talking about some other things, but, you know, just kind of trying to find a way there. And I'm having a hard time with it.
You didn't plan ahead.
Out what to do next. I really didn't plan what I was going to say here. So I'm just going to throw it to our guest, Sharon.
I'm Sharon Biswas. I'm delighted to be back for what, fourth time, right?
Yes.
And I know I'm sorry. It's very hard for me to schedule things, but we made it. I am a game designer, writer, and interactive artist. I also regularly teach games at NYU's Game Center, at the Tisch School of the Arts, and at Fordham University, and I sometimes teach other places. I was visiting faculty at Dartmouth recently. And I'm excited, and I really loved how Craig foreshadowed our topic.
Yes.
That was really well done.
Completely unplanned. Wait, how do you know what our topic is? We didn't decide on a topic before we got here.
To be fair, I didn't know I was going to do that until the moment I started doing it. And I was like, oh, this is where this can go.
I've been thinking a lot about foreshadowing recently because I think we did a good job in Agatha All Along. A lot of interesting foreshadowing. Also, 3 weeks ago, I was depressed and bought Knights of the Old Republic 1. For my iPad, because it's like $9 for the iPad. I've only played the sex sequel, so I got one for the first time. And, you know, it's a 20-something-year-old game, so I know the big reveal at the end. But what's really interesting is playing the game. It's a very well-written game. Playing the game and looking for all the foreshadowing and clues that they drop to the big reveal. And that's actually, like, the first person you speak to when you land on the first planet gives you, like, tells you the ending, and you're like, oh, haha, you're a crazy old man, ha, ha, ha. But you're like, you just told me the ending. So I've been thinking about foreshadowing a lot.
We need more topic lists for our show, so I'm going to steal that. I'm going to put that on the topic list. But that's not what we're talking about today. What are we talking about?
Lovingly borrow. You're going to love
the opposite.
The opposite of foreshadowing.
Yeah, kind of the opposite. Yeah, we're going to talk about flying by the seat of your pants, improvising in general, but I think kind of improvising everything. Like, you decide, you know, we're going to have a game. I just didn't have any time to plan for it, or I just wasn't up for it this week or whatever. And I'm just going to make up some crap when we play.
Yeah.
And talking about, you know, GMing that and maybe even touching a little bit on some design stuff. But to start with, like, what do you do? First of all, I guess, Sharon, you picked this from our list of topics. What gets you excited about running by the seat of your pants?
Well, this is actually very funny and meta. One reason I picked this topic was I'm like, I won't have to do a lot of reading because the topic itself is about running by the seat of your pants. So maybe I shouldn't do any reading because all the other topics I have sat an hour or so or a bit more and be like, let me go through the literature or let me go through my games collection to see. I spent minutes thinking right before our call, being like, let me think of some games that this is relevant to. And actually quite interesting, I was just talking to you guys before we started recording about Dragon Age, which I started basically as soon as it released. And this idea of open world games or very, like, strictly authored kind of games. And, of course, video games are never the pants, right? They do not have the ability to be. But they can create that feeling, right? I would say, like, you can argue that Skyrim, a very open-world game, feels like, you know, you're just doing things and whatever, while Dragon Age Origins feels very plotted. Now, I was talking about how, in video games, I like a very plotted feel versus a very open world feel. I don't like open world games that much. But in tabletop role-playing games and LARP, possibly because of the affordance of the medium and because it's a social kind of medium, I kind of enjoy sometimes when GMs, and this is me saying I'm often the GM, when I'm not the GM, I often do enjoy when the GM's like, we're just gonna see what happens, right? And that also might be depending on the game system, right? Because some game systems afford that very well, and some game systems is more challenging to do that. And I think I just went on a ramble and didn't actually answer the question you asked, Craig. What was the actual question?
No, I mean, but you just touched on something that was, that's like, I think super huge for it. There are systems that like you're going to have a really hard time improvising in. Like if you have a, like, you can do it because I've done it plenty of times, but a game like Dungeons and Dragons where you need stat blocks for enemies, you need traps ready, you need what all this stuff, you need a direction for them to go. Like, yes, could you just open up your book and find a random monster in the monster manual and throw it at the players? Sure, but you also have to know like what the challenge rating of this monster is, balance it out. It's harder as a GM to improvise something like that versus, for example, like a Monster of the Week game where all you need really is the idea of what the monster is and how they're going to maybe beat it. And then you just kind of let the players improv through the rest of it. And there are some games that specifically tell you not to plan ahead. Last weekend, I was in the mood for playing a spooky game because it was the weekend before Halloween. I was like, oh, who wants to play a spooky game with me? I have some options. And I brought Home, which is not a game that you have to prep for at all. And it's totally a game of improv where you answer prompts on cards and you build rooms and you tell a scary story. I brought Dread, which you have to plan a little bit for, but not really all that much. And then someone else brought 10 candles, which specifically tells you in the rules, do not prepare anything. Here's the basic story. It's dark. They're here. You're going to die. Don't plan anything else. the rest of it, like,
that's really funny though, right?
They're for it. Yeah.
Because one would imagine maybe that horror is a genre that you need to plan for, right? Because one might imagine, oh, but we need to plan for pacing, because, you know, horror is all about pacing and atmosphere. But that's really interesting that many of the games that you're saying that don't require that much prep are horror games.
Yeah, I think it might be because we as humans know what is scary to us personally, and having a little bit of, like, all of those games are, except for Dread, well, even with Dread, with 10 candles and with Home, the point is that you have everybody kind of telling the story together, and what might be scary to me might not be scary to you, but we're going to be describing it together, and you never know really what's going to end up being frightening for you, but you do know what things are that are scary because you are a human being and you get scared. And I think that is easier than, say, like a fantasy game where, okay, you don't necessarily know what's in this world. You don't necessarily know, okay, well, what's the relationship between this civilization and that civilization? And I think that that's why that, and sci-fi too, like, how does this science work? We're not experts in that in the same way that we are experts of this human emotion of fear, this very, not even human emotion. This is a living being emotion. Fear for all sentient creatures. And I think that that's what makes that works.
Yeah, and this brings up, so Avery Alder, I was writing an article for Killscreen years ago about why adults love teenage stories, so not about horror at all, but there's an ancient interview that Avery Alder gave for a magazine where she says she got the idea for Monster Hearts from Twilight. Because she said bad fiction makes for good games. And I think she elaborated a bit, but I've spoken to Avery, I mean, I'm friends with Avery Alder, I talk to her a lot. But I think the idea there is that TTRPGs and LARP, role-playing games, feed a lot on our ideas of what the shapes of stories are and tropes that exist in stories. And we love them, right? Like, silly tropes that if we read a fiction novel, I'd be like, this is so hackneyed and boring. Why am I reading this? But in a game, I'm like, yeah, I totally want to embody this trope, but I want to recreate this idea. And I think that is very relevant to what you're saying. Like, we know what a horror story's shape is. And so it's easy in a communal storytelling environment for us to recreate what we will find satisfying. And I think that is a key to improvisational games That maybe may what I mean. Obviously, I have done an experiment on this, but maybe people who are like 16 years old versus people who are 36 years old, there's a difference with who can run pantsed games or seat of the pants games or improv games better, because one of them will just have more experience with the kinds of stories people like to consume and create.
Absolutely. Craig, you've made a couple horror games that I think involve a lot of improv. Like, I'm thinking about Die Laughing, not necessarily like horrifying, more comedy horror.
Yeah.
Do you think that, okay, tell you can take over from there.
What's your theory on what all been saying? I think that when it comes to games, horror games tend to, if it's a straightforward horror game and not some like really layered thing that there's more going on, like, you know, your typical horror story is like, you know, monster or killer or something, you know, natural disaster, something trying to kill you, animal, whatever, and you're trying to survive, and that's really simple to latch onto. There's a thing that's trying to kill me, I'm afraid of it, I'm nervous, like will I act now, I have to act, and we play out the story. And I think that probably bleeds over to, you could improvise a game that's really all about characters falling in and out of love. Let's say, like, that's what the game's all about. Like, even if you personally have never fallen in and out of love or don't have a lot of experience with relationships and stuff, you've seen enough stuff, you know, that has that basic trope of like how characters fall into love and how they fall out of love and what sort of difficulties they run into. So you could improvise something like that very easily because it's a simple enough focus. Common. As soon as if you wanted to try to improvise a horror game experience that gave you the RPG version of, let's say, Hereditary.
I was literally just thinking which about goes Hereditary.
So much deeper than there's an evil thing that wants to kill us. It's about who it's after, why they're after, who these other characters are, what the history of the main character is, what the history of the mom is, you know, the main character's mom is. There's like plenty of foreshadowing that happens with certain characters having problems that they have to deal with, and that problem becomes a bigger problem for everybody later. There's all sorts of things that happen. You know, and I think there are games that are harder probably to improvise your way through. Simply because they're more complex games, that can be overcome by you being very, very familiar with the game. The more you run it, the more experience you have just dealing with what the game does. And with, you know, certainly just age, it can come out of age, just, but that doesn't mean that, you know, somebody who's 20 years old can't, you know, improvise a hell of a really depth, you know, web of deceit kind of political game. Because it's, you know, it's the game that they've been playing straight for 3 years. They've been GMing it for 3 years straight. They know it inside and out. So that's, I think, you know, as far as advice to GMs goes for improvising, is it's going to go better probably if you know the game very well, if you know the game world very well, or if you know the tropes and themes that are kind of part of that type of a story. And you can do that in a game that's more, you know, if you've got a game that has a lot of different things that you can do, you could just have the improvised story be like, oh, well, I'm going to just make this like there's somebody coming to get him. It's going to be fighty, fighty, fight. And I can just use these stat blocks that are in the book for generic thugs. And I'll just give them some flavor, you know, skin them into something interesting. And I know the rules well enough that I can like give this person this attack instead of this kind of attack or whatever. You just mix things up from the stat block. You know, you can do all that stuff in your head because you know the game so well.
And I'm thinking of the example that Jess gave, the specific example of D&D, right? And yes, if you know the game well, you could improvise. But I think D&D has a couple of things going against it in terms of ease of improvisation, right? So Craig, you already mentioned that it is a more complicated system. And Jess was like, yeah, you need to do encounter belts and stuff. But in addition to that, there's also this idea that D&D is a game that you can actually lose. Right. Mm-hmm. And so if you badly balance an encounter, the players will lose and you will all feel bad. Right. While in Monster of the Week, just another example, yes, you can sort of lose, but the PBTA system was designed with the idea in mind that players' failures have interesting consequences, right? Mm-hmm. And so those kinds of games, like I'm thinking of a game like Masks, right? About supervillains and teen heroes. In Masks, the supervillain like succeeds, great. The story just becomes richer. Now you're all trapped in the supervillain's lair, or now you're all in someone else's body, or now you have to reverse time, you know, all kinds of things, right? So that's a couple of things going like, well, D&D, you actively feel bad because, oh no, we lost. Now we're all dead. And now what, right? Yes, you can do a similar thing like in Masks and be like, well, we're going to do some narrative special things and we're ghosts now and we're going to go back to what you can do that. But the game isn't designed with that in mind, right? The game will feel bad if you lose. And I was thinking of a game like Numenera, which has the similar problem as that, like you can lose it, but the complexity problem is a bit reduced because it's very easy to make like monsters on the fly, and being a game that's a lot about combat, that's an important part of improvisation. But also Numenera has the funny, Numenera by Montica Games has the funny cheat that Numenera is all about discovering weird things whose answers you will never know. Because it's about like a post-apocalypse 1 billion years in the future stuff. So if you're stuck, just look around you, find some random object in your house and be like, how do I make this completely unknowable and bizarre? And give it to the players and they're going to be like, oh, what's the solution? Well, there is none. And the game, they know that, right? They're playing the game and like, oh yeah, we find lots of weird stuff that there's no explanation for. It's just weird.
That's funny. With the right player group, that's a half hour role play that you can just sit back and enjoy the show.
Yeah.
And you're on your way to improvising your way through this episode.
And I think the genius of a system of Brindlewood Bay and its successors is that those games take that philosophy, for want of a better word, to an extreme, right? Because those are all mystery solving games. Mm. And the philosophy of Brindlewood Bay, I probably talked about it earlier in this podcast because I really like it a lot, is that they're all mystery solving game, but neither the author nor the GM nor the players know the solution to the mystery. And you make up the solution to the mystery as you play, right? You get these random clues, and then at one point in the game, you pause and you're like, okay, who do we think is a murderer based on the random clues? And that person is now the murderer. Let's go. right? The each mystery sheet in OG Brindlewood Bay is 2 pages long. In the newer, in the successive games that have come out based on the same engine, they might be 3 pages long. But it's based on this idea that a GM was not going to plan the mystery because writing or the author, because writing mysteries that are satisfying is actually challenging, right? Like mystery authors have been thinking about this for decades and decades. And let's just not do that. And let's just have the players come up with the solution. So that's the ultimate pantsing, right?
I mean, that's spectacular for a mystery game because of how, like, when you're writing a mystery novel, for example, you really have to make sure you have all the foreshadowing, the clues, they're all ready to go. This is sort of reverse engineering that, which is very, very a cool way to work with that problem. And picking the right system that allows you to improv, I mean, super huge. Talking about failure and whether or not you can fail, there are also games that are designed so everyone fails.
Fail. Like you were talking about Dread and
right. Or ten Fiasco.
Ten Candles, yeah.
Fiasco is meant for everybody to, we're all fucking the story up. We don't know, it doesn't matter where it goes as long as we are all, well, we're all going to mess up at the very end. It's going to be a fiasco. And planning something like that ahead of time is completely counterproductive to that game. It just doesn't work. Just if you're going to play a mystery game and you're going to play a mystery game where you need to know who the killer is and why they did it and all blah, 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 you can't improv your way through that. It's going to make the whole thing fall apart. If you're doing a dungeon crawl that's super complex and convoluted with traps, puzzles, and you want it to be like this whole thing, you can't improvise your way through that. But there will be systems that will allow you to do that. some of my favorites. So,
and I love that, right? This idea of system. I was thinking of Bluebeard's Bride, where the game says don't plan, because ask your player what the key looks like and then make up what the room is on the spot based on that key. I think that's really cool because that brings in a lot of like resonance with like visuals of the game and themes of the game, and also players feel like, yeah, what I'm saying is matters a lot, and is reflected in the world. Not just my decision. It's not just like I was mean to the Lord and now the Lord hates us, like that decisions, but like, no, I described a visual and now our entire encounter is based on this one of me saying the key has butterfly wings on it or something, right? And I think that's cool. I love how the game is like, do this. Which is, that's why I think it's kind of weird that Bluebeard's Bride later released an expansion, which is, here are lots of rooms and encounters. And I'm like, why did you do that? But what I do is I have gone through that book and I like have just read some details here and there. And now I have what we were just talking about, tropes and ideas in mind, so that when I do improv something, I have like some ideas that I can draw from. So that's what I use the book for. And I think most people who run Bluebeard's Bride use the book for that. And exactly what you're saying, Craig, like once you know a game well, like if you're an expert D&D dungeon master, like, I don't know, if you're any of the famous ones, for example, if you're Abria Iyengar or whatever, you know the game so well, you know numbers, you know what experience level is needed and stuff, you can do it. But for most people, or for people like me who live in New York and never have time to do anything, that would be more challenging to do, right? So, yeah.
What about for like the game? So you have your game ready to go. You're already playing the game. You're in the middle of a campaign and it's suddenly Saturday, the night where you you're supposed to run your game. And you haven't planned anything. What are your strategies specifically like from us? You can't go out and change the system. You can't go grab a new book.
Yeah.
What do we do? What do we do in situations like that?
So I think the number of strategies. First, if you're playing a very combat-y game, then maybe plan for like minimal combat for that. If you think of a combat-y game that requires very carefully planned encounters, because there are combat-y games that don't require very carefully planned encounters, right? But if you're doing that, maybe like plan that, okay, there's going to be an easy encounter, there's some easy fighting today, and that's fine. Like, not every encounter has to be super tactically challenging. So balance, I would say it's better for that kind of game to balance on this, to imbalance on the side of too easy versus too hard, right? Mm-hmm. Because too hard, again, creates that whole thing of like, the party's like, what's up? Or unless you're like, this is too hard an encounter, but that's on purpose and the party's going to have to beg for mercy or whatever, right? So plan something really quick that doesn't hinge on like, okay, we need to like fight a lot. But something else I'd do is, if I have not a lot of time, I'm assuming I have like 15 to 20 minutes, go into you hopefully have notes about your character if you're playing that kind of game, and select one to two characters, look at their stories, look at their backstories, look at what the players have told you they want to explore with those characters, and be like, great, this session, these two things, and I'm going to focus on this person's backstory, right? Let's say this person is like, I'm looking for my long lost sister. So be like, great, in this session, I'm going to put in NPCs that have seen this sister and dated this sister, and let's start, you're going to meet this and create some drama there. I think throwing in character moments is a good way to address this, because, you know, players like to role play. They're called role-playing games, right? And players can take a lot of time up role-playing. So if you give them a compelling character, and an easy way to make a character compelling is to tie them to someone's backstory, they will want to spend time doing things with or to that character.
With or to.
Right, there we go. I'm teaching a new class on romance and sex and games next semester, so
so it's on your mind.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of reading.
Wouldn't be a Sharong episode if there wasn't a brief reference to people boning.
It's all academic. New class
next semester. Yes.
So I think yeah, I really do like a lot of it's a silly joke that D&D players often talk about, and GM's talking about, like, yeah, I planned this whole encounter, but the player spent the whole time flirting with the shopkeeper, right? And it's because they found the character compelling. And of course, people find the character compelling for different reasons, but like I said, an easy way to make a character compelling is tie it to someone's backstory. So that's something I would do. Another thing I do, there's a technique I learned, not while pantsing, when I was writing an adventure once for Cyphercaster magazine, which was an old, I think it still runs a little bit, it's an old Cypher System magazine. I use this trick where there are two mysterious things going on simultaneously, but the phenotype or the consequences of them are seen at the same time by the player, right? They see all these things and they assume that it's all one mystery. It's actually two separate mysteries that just happen to be in the same geographic space. Right. So obviously not the mystery part, because like just said, mysteries are kind of hard to plan. But if you are like, I want to do something with adventure, I'd be like, okay, what if I tie in two people's backstories at the same time? They're both, these things are going to happen in the space. Having two things is fun because one, it gives variety, and two, players will spend a little bit of time untangling, being like, are these the same thing? No, these are not. It's like, if one player looking for their sister and the other player wants to kill the bandit king, you could be like, okay, some bandits are attacking and there's this woman there who claimed that she used to date your sister. These are separate things, but now they've become linked. And to the players, they're like, are these linked? Is the sister connected to the bandits? Probably not. The good part of role-playing is if they really love that, you can also just change your mind partway and be like, you know what? Yes, now they are. The sister used to date the bandit king as well because she was really believed in free love, you know? and you can change your mind. But the technique of weaving together multiple separate things, I have found to be very powerful, because it adds this air of mystery a little bit. We talk about this air of mystery a lot. Without actually being a full mystery, it's just, oh, two different things going on. And then you just have to untangle them. I think that's a very powerful technique.
It does take a little bit of thought, just a little bit of forethought at that point. But it's still, I think that still counts as pantsing. Having an idea, like, I'm going to do this one thing and I don't know how I'm going to accomplish it. I'm going to make them do most of the work. I mean, yeah. Most of the games that I play, most of the games that I run are predominantly me improvising in some way. And the thing like that I love the most about a lot of the Powered by the Apocalypse games, and the one that I've created as well, is that we can have the links. There's like a whole time dedicated between the characters to develop relationships with the other characters and develop relationships with the world, and all I have to do is let them sit and kind of create those ideas,
yeah,
and listen and generate just a couple of ideas to throw in when they don't know what to do or when they don't have an idea of where to go next. That's my job as the GM in those games, is to, oh, you're not doing anything, here's something, well, how about that? And here's another thing. You said this earlier. How about that? And you don't have to do any of the generation. They are already, when they're creating these ideas, they're already thinking about, ooh, wouldn't it be cool if, even if they don't say it out loud, and then you just give it to them and then they will do stuff with it. Like you said, the players want to role play. They want to do those things and they will do it for a long time.
Yeah, and I love that you talk about PBTA games. Like, I'm thinking of a game, I'm thinking of Masks again, right? Or thinking of Monster Hearts, where scenes of the players just debriefing with each other are powerful and important, right?
Yeah.
In Masks, there are actual game moves for when you celebrate a triumph with another team member, right? Or when you are openly vulnerable. So, and extrapolate that to any game, right? If your players last week stole the major Star Destroyer core from the giant ship, you can do a whole scene where they're sitting in a bar and then someone comes up to them and is like, "Where'd you stole the Star Destroyer core? Wow, what was that like?" And the players can just talk at this NPC for a while. and like having these narrative moments can be really powerful, right? Or you could be like, "Oh, last thing, your mom died, right? Killed by the big bad. This scene, you're going to have people come to you, or you're going to talk to each other in this scene about, like, how does it feel that your mom was killed by the big bad? Does this fuel your thing?" And the idea of asking a lot of questions to the players is a thing that a lot of RPG books just say that you should do, right? Ask questions. And they can be like state of the player, state of the character, state of the world questions, like, how do you feel about this? What do you think about this? But they can also be like, if you want to move the story forward but you haven't planned a lot, you can ask things like, when was the last time this happened and why do you think it's going to happen again? Or when was the last time this person wronged you? Like, make up a new character and, oh yeah, the witch queen of the southern waste, what did she steal from you that you will never forgive her for? Just on the fly, make up a dumb question, and they play like, she stole my dignity, right? and then how? Oh, she insulted me in front of the Orlesian court. No, that's Dragon Age. Whatever. We're talking in front of the court, right? There's Dragon Age RPG. I have it. And then those answers will, like you said, Jess, give you things that you can just then give them, right? Be like, ah, yes, let's move with this, right?
Well, and the trick is you're using that time where they are blah, blah, blah. You use that time to plan what's next. Like, you're using that mini planning time that they're granting you while they're arguing with each other in character, or they're having their emotional moments. And like, that's always the hardest part though, is when they are talking and you are trying to listen, but also think. or sometimes also then role play an NPC at the same time. Like, there's a lot of hats you have to wear as a GM when, like, the reason we plan is so it's not so like, cognitive and mental and emotional load for us while we are playing the game.
And it can be fun. Some people love planning, right?
Yes. But some people love pantsing. They can balance that out. I think like what we said in the beginning, it does take experience, not just like within your own life experience, but also your experience running games. It's way easier for me to improv a game now than when I was a teenager and I didn't have a lot of experience playing. Now I have decades of experience, a couple of decades of experience playing games now. Gosh, I have 20 years of games experience since I was 13. There we go. I can use all of that and all those tools and tricks that I've developed to make it easier for me. I always have something in my bag of tricks.
And I like this idea of like thinking while they're talking, because you can very explicitly do this. Like, for example, okay, they want to storm the Temple of Elemental Evil, right? That you are making. Obviously, that exists, but whatever. Like, the Temple of Shadow Evil that you're making up next week, right? You can be like, okay, well, you need to research what the defenses are and then have the players tell you what the defenses are, right? Because, okay, you go to Radagast the Brown. Oh, God, I'm not coming up with my own things today. I'm just stealing from all the books I've ever read. You're speaking to the wizard Radagast, and then you can ask them, a player, what rumor have you heard is one of the defenses? And the player will be like, oh, I've heard that there are, I don't know, man-eating crows there. And you're like, great. And you can write that down in your sheet, man-eating crows. So either later in the session or next week, you now have one of the things. And also, the player will feel good because they'll be like, oh, yeah, I made that, right? Or you can tweak it a little bit. If they're like, they're man-eating crows, you're like, actually, they're man-eating peacocks, but the rumor mill turned them into crows. So the player was like, oh, did I talk about man-eating birds? But I thought they were crows. Oh, haha, the GM took that and twisted it, right? and it makes sense because rumors work that way, right?
Right.
So having the players tell you what they want to see is like powerful, because I mean, that's all of you want to see. That all of you want to play a game where you see things that you're excited about and stuff, right? It's, yes, sometimes surprise is great, but if you're pantsing, I mean, if you're pantsing, everything's gonna be surprising, but sometimes you use the strategies that you have, and this kind of thing can be very valuable and very cool.
A tool that you can use to help you do those rumors and predictions and things like that is a nice deck of tarot cards. And then you can literally do a little spread of tarot and have them interpret it.
Yeah.
Well, you visit a seer in this town, and she's going to tell you what's going to happen next. Here are the cards she gives you. How do you interpret them? And if you have, I mean, if your players kind of know anything about tarot, I guess even if they don't, they can.
Yeah, they will still have ideas of what does this image mean, right?
Like... Right. You could even make a big show of picking certain cards from the deck, even if you don't actually, you're not actually picking anything. You're really picking randomly, but like, yeah, you're like going through and you're throwing things out. They're going to think that you are trying to give them a message when really you're giving them nothing.
you're not really giving them anything. Yeah.
Like all sorts of things like that. Little, I love the idea of making them for you.
Yeah. And there's also this idea of randomizing elements. It's a good, like, a lot of games come with random tables, right? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, they do that. It is no crime to use a random table from one game for a different game, right? Like, you can be inspired by a random table for Numenera in D&D. Perhaps maybe you won't use the exact same thing, but the inspiration is there. So I would say use those kinds of things. Be like, oh, that's gonna happen now, and throw that in as well. So I think that's randomizing is cool, because sometimes your brain just like, oh, I can't think of anything, look at the existing randomly different game, even, or tarot, which is not meant for that kind of play necessarily, and be like, bam, that. And I like this idea of tarot a lot, because you could actually make that a character moment where there is a seer who, I'm thinking of Agatha all along again, right? But there's a seer who pulls out the tarot and is like, what lies in your future? And so that becomes an interaction moment, which with a compelling NPC, hopefully, that the players then do. And then that those tarot results then become part of the actual storyline itself, which is cool.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself, when I'm dealing with improvising like this, I gain a lot of guidance from having done like actual like improv, like taking classes and performed and improv comedy or long form improv, and I'm not saying that, you know, you should necessarily go out there and like join the local improv troupe, but you know, taking a class, even if it's, you know, just like one thing at a community center or neighborhood thing or whatever,
at a convention. They do improv classes at conventions.
To just give yourself a little confidence, learn the precepts of what it is to kind of cooperatively build. And because you're doing that anyway, like with, if you're planning stuff, you're coming out and you're jamming and you're still, you know, building the story together, because the player's impact on your plans will always be important. Yeah. But, you know, like a lot of people talk like, you know, the classic improv thing is yes and, right? Like always agree with what's been said to you and then add something, always say something more. That's, you know, that's for improv. In with GMing, there can sometimes also be yes, but like, yeah, you can do this, but you're going to have to deal with this thing.
Often, especially PBTA game, where they're like, what's the cost or consequence, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, but.
And no, and you know, no, but. No, you can't do that, but there's, and here's an option. Here's another way to do the thing you're trying to do. You can't swim up the waterfall because that's impossible, but, you know, here's like vines and things that are hanging down on the trees.
You can't swim up the waterfall, but you can if you steal a scale from the Mermaid Queen.
There you go.
You can turn into the waterfall.
And the way I kind of keep it in mind too when I'm GMing is like, if the players ask you a question, the answer is never, ever nothing. The word nothing or the descriptive equivalent of there being nothing. You know, they walk up to they found the secret room and they're at the hidden door and they listen. I listen at the door. What do I hear? Nothing. Blah. Okay, well, now they just have to open the door blindly or turn around and walk away. But
yeah, the player, you know, what do I hear? Something is a signal ticking. That they want to know about it, right?
Yeah.
Right. What do I hear? Ticking. And you can be improvising this because now Sharang was talking about like when the players talk, they give you time. They give you time to figure out the thing, even if they don't come up with something. So like, you know, they hear ticking. Okay, well, now the players are talking about what could the ticking be? Are we going to try to protect ourselves? You know what? And they may offer the perfect solution to you. Like, oh, obviously that's what the ticking is. That's something I can go with. Or they're at least spending some time talking that you come up with what you're going to go with. So you didn't necessarily have to have it ready to go. And that goes to everything you do. Like anytime the players ask you a question or prompt you for information, you give them an answer that forces a discussion or presents a possible discussion or prompts another question. Yeah. Or more than one question, so that there's always something to go on. Like just saying that, if you're going to try to improvise your way through a mystery game or an investigative game, that's something you're absolutely going to need to do. You can't just tell the people trying to solve the mystery. Do we find something underneath the trash can? No.
This is
okay. Well, what do I do now?
I'm thinking of Dragon Age again, right? Because I'm playing Veilguard, and the level design of Veilguard is very interesting because there are all these small side rooms and areas that you can always go to in every level, but they're never empty, right? Because if there's a side room, you go there, you'll find a small thing in there. The same thing with what you're saying, Craig, is that if the players are like, what's in the box, it's boring to say nothing. You can say there's a bit of slime in the box, like some dead thing was once here, or there's dried flowers, right? Anything, even if it's not super plot necessary or mechanically necessary, these kinds of things add color, they add role playing, they emphasize the world, they emphasize the themes. I think that's a really great phrase or statement idea that you put, Craig. Like if players ask you, you should never say nothing. That's a very clever thing. Also, and the idea of the improv, Karen Twelves, a very prolific editor of lots of RPGs, has a great book called Improv. It's either called Improv for Gamers or Improv for Game Designers. I can't remember exactly. But it's a book about, because she did a lot of improv comedy when she was a little bit younger. So this idea of using improv techniques in gaming has been codified into Karen Twelves' book. And I haven't read it, disclaimer, but I've heard it's really, really good. Also, Karen Twelves has done a lot of editing work for me, and she's really great. So listeners, check out the book.
Name dropping over there.
I think even if there is nothing in the box, because sometimes you don't want anything to be in the box, you could then distract the players from it. Like they're going, they're looking in the box, you find nothing, and then this, like, you should have something next ready to go, even if there's nothing necessarily in there.
Not in the box, now it's outside the box, right? Something did happen, yeah.
Right.
While you look in the box, the demon clown from the local high school has now snuck up behind you, right?
Right.
No, but I'm going to remember that, Craig, that phrasing, like, don't say no. Because even with your caveat, Jess, it's the spirit.
It's still something. Right?
The spirit is the same. Yeah, I'm going to remember that.
You did a thing. You asked for the thing. And here it is. Yeah, that's really good. That's just good GMing advice.
The best stories come from that, right? I remember playing 13th Age long time ago with some New York gamers. And we were in some town. And I'm like, I'm going to ask a passerby this information. We need some information about myself. I'm going to ask a passerby. And then we asked, I'm like, how attractive is this character? And our GM's like, okay, well, I don't know. Let's roll for it. It was an 8. I'm like, I want to flirt with this character now, which I know is a creepy thing to do in real life. You don't do that in real life. But in a game, if someone says that, they just want a certain kind of story, right? So in the story, I started flirting with the character, and then that character became important because the GM's like, great, we've introduced character. We have some details about him now, blah, blah. And then I started dating him later. He was some like blacksmith's apprentice. It was hot. And that again, this answer of not nothing, right? Let us establish this fact about this character became interesting and became important later on, right? So
how can we design games that allow us to improv, that allow people to improv? What are some specific designer moves we can make?
make the game simpler. Don't make it full of lots of complexity and rules and granularism, and it wants to be realistic and all this sort of thing, because you're going to trying to find the right stat block or whip up a complex monster or baddie or whatever supervillain on the fly.
I think, can be tough. I think
if the game is, it's tougher if the game is more, is very complex. So if the simpler the game is, the better chance you have of people being able to.
I think simulationism is the enemy improv-ing. Which sounds weird, because if you think of a video game, simulationism means you can do all kinds of things, you have freedom. But in role-playing games, in analog games, it's not. I think having a game where the players have keys to the narrative flow is a way to do this, because like Jess was saying, having the players do your work for you then, right? If the players can, like in Brindlewood Bay, the players... decide who the murderer is, right? So having them be able to, giving them mechanics to be able to control the actual structure of the game is a good way of doing that. Having games that don't punish failure is another way to do that, because if the players can fail, they'll do random stuff and you can do random stuff. But players can't fail, because then they'll have TPK and you're like, now what? Oh God, the Demogorgon is going to destroy the world now. Whoops. Having the fail modes can be challenging for that. What else? Having games where players have lots of ways of getting to a solution. So I'm thinking of Blades in the Dark, right? Blades in the Dark, even if their roles and whatever are bad, players can use flashbacks, right? So if you've given them a challenge that's extremely difficult and they can't, and you're like, oh shit, that challenge is actually too hard. If it's the kind of game where players have lots of ways of solving things, like the flashback mechanic, that also makes improving easier, because you have to worry less about, oh, did I make a mistake or not, right?
I'm thinking about all of the games that I feel like do improv the best, and all of them do have some sort of what happens when you fail mechanic built in, like telling you if you were successful, unsuccessful, really successful, not very successful, like mixed successes. They all have some sort of element like that in there. And even just having that kind of framework, like, yes, you succeed with a complication. It like gives you a frame with which to narrate what happens next. I think that's like the number one simple thing. And I totally agree with Craig. Like, the simpler the system is, the easier it is to improv. It's overwhelming enough to plan with a really complex system. So
also, and this might sound paradoxical at first, but giving a lot of details that a GM can draw from might actually be the opposite of what you want to do, because that means this GM has to sit and read all that, right? And will be done, oh no, I have to actually prep and read this. Instead, giving player, giving a GM a tiny list of bullet point words, or just the impression of what's going on here, is it makes it easier to improv, because the GM will only read something for 5 seconds and be like, everything here is poisonous and royal, right? Like, this is the theme of this room, poisonous and aristocrat, right? You get, great, what does that mean? There is a zombie king here who with a poison dagger, or there is a magic ring here that will poison you, or there is a banquet set out here that's poisonous. That's much better, having poisonous and royal there, rather than in this room to the left there is a table, on the table there are 7 dishes, on the 7 dishes, because the GM has to then be like, get it right. If I get it wrong, that's wrong. So as a designer, giving these like impressions that the GM can then build on is often much more valuable for improv than giving like all these specific things, you know. Right, like just with the thing I made up right now, royal and poisonous, we came up with like 3-4 different things, right?
So yeah, and I'm thinking about royal poisonous plants, a garden of sentient poisonous plants.
Yeah, the sovereign of the plant of right. Most poisonous, right?
Right.
Yeah, so that's actually, I think some of the best games are like minimalist in that way. Now, like Jess and Craig said, maybe those games require you to have a little more experience to run. Maybe not everyone can just be like poisonous and royal. What am I gonna make? That might be true, but I think you only get better by practicing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other design things?
I was thinking too, having the game have some sort of player driving, you know, describing things or driving some minor narrative elements and things. Normally as part of the game. So like it, that, mm-hmm. that alone takes, some of the load off of you as the GM, because you know, you're going to ask loaded questions, or the players are going to be encouraged to like fill out some detail. And maybe that's even in, not just described and encouraged as part of gameplay, but maybe it's in, there's a mechanic for it as well. You've got points that you can spend to do interesting things that kind of swerve the narrative. And so giving that all in there, just like every it's, I think, you know, a watchdog phrase maybe for doing this is, creating plenty of aids, you know, plenty of tools that are really easy to implement.
Mm-hmm.
So none of the tools are clear, you know, like, oh, this, you know, to use this tool, you got to do all this crap. It's like, nobody's going to want to do that because that's too long of a process or whatever. When there's this other thing you can do. Yeah. Just making sure that like every little thing that could help the GM. And some of those things are things like the players get to, you know, make some narrative choices. Give the GM a bunch of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or even if it's a slightly more complex game with like stat blocks and stuff, maybe there's a few simple, depending on how you've got your numbers and your math balance, there might be a simple way to say like, you can whip up an NPC on the fly with just four numbers and you can just use that for the, you know, you use those in these ways. So you just have to, you know, assign a trait, you know, assign a score to four different things. And
that's
all you need for this particular system.
Yeah.
So again, and, you know, that comes back to simpler.
Yeah. And I think another thing is when writing adventures and things, like kind of what we were saying before, but creating space for players to have downtime to talk about plans or emotions is good, because one, players like doing that, especially if there's an NPC involved. But two, it interests them, right? They create moments in the game, but also it lets them talk about things that interest them, and then you can incorporate that into your stuff. And creating literal space for that in the game, I think, is powerful.
And I mean, finally, I think I've said it before, I'm a very big proponent of writing out how you want people to play a game as the writer of the game, giving them a manifesto, giving them like, this is what you're doing in the game. I'm writing that out very specifically. It takes a little bit of the fear away of acting wrongly, quote unquote wrongly. It's there in the book. They say that I can't do anything wrong. So here I am, and I'm going to do what I want. Just having that little bit of permission, especially for new players. Like, I don't necessarily need that permission, but I've been playing games for a long time. Somebody who's new to the hobby might need that permission. They might need that little push, or just a little go sign. They just need a green light to tell them that what they're doing is okay, and then they'll feel more comfortable with doing it.
And that that goes toward, as a final word, that goes toward, remember, and I've brought this up a few times in this podcast, remember that as the GM, unless you're playing a very, very specific type of game, the players are on your side.
Yeah.
Like, they want you to do well. They want you to present interesting things and adjudicate them nicely and fairly and help to tell a story. They want you to be able to fill that role. So don't go in there assuming that, like, oh, if I, you know, I haven't planned for this, and they're going to know, they're going to be able to tell, like, they're going to get so disappointed with me, or somebody's going to be mad that I didn't take the time that they took when they super planned things, or whatever gets in your head, right? Your emotions. Mm-hmm. You can throw all that out the window, because the players are on your side.
Yeah, ideally you're playing with friends who care about you. So yeah. Though there is a conceivable scenario where you're playing with your worst enemies and you have to, like, I don't know, get them to agree this thing, and you're doing that through a high stakes, instead of a high stakes poker match, you're doing a high stakes TTRPG game. Now that needs to be a
game. Okay, Bond that movie. Needs to be a game.
Yes. Yes.
And you know what? It can still be a game where everyone fails at the end because the house always wins. And as the GM, you're playing the house. You know how it goes. Although, hold on. Let me break the fourth wall of this podcast a little bit and ask my husband something. Hey, Alex, what is that gambling game that Benny really likes that you like too?
Pai Gow.
There's a gambling game called Pai Gow where, like you are very cooperative at the table, at the gambling table. You could make a game like that. It doesn't have to be adversarial.
That was a long way to go for that point.
Now I'm imagining
that was a journey.
Daniel Craig sitting there, and then Le Chiffre opposite him. Instead of holding cards, they're like moving miniatures now on the Bourbon Forge set. And I'm like, that's amazing.
Honestly, I would go to a casino like that. John, thank you so much for coming on the podcast again. Yes,
thank you.
Thank you for inviting me all the time. It's so fun.
Where can we find you and your stuff?
Yeah, so I am barely using Twitter anymore, even though my previous episode will say that I was, because that's when, you know, Twitter changes. I post a lot on Blue Sky now. You should just search Sharang Biswas again. And I'm a little bit on Instagram, Sharang Biswas. And someone once told me I should make a newsletter. And I'm like, but that's a lot more writing I have to do. And I write for a living. That's like too much writing. That might happen. But right now, my Blue Sky and my Instagram are great. My website, I don't update very often. I do have some stuff there. And then there's my itch, which is astrolingus.itch.io, where I just put a random experimental game about fungus eating you alive a couple of weeks ago. It's for free. And you play it by eating meals every day. And then you use that as your prompt, and then the end of the game tells you what kind of meal you should eat the next day, as your fungus has killed someone and blossomed and is spreading into the world. Yeah, it's. I was just like, I'm like, I haven't made a tiny. I'm on all these really big projects right now, and I'm like, I haven't made a tiny game in a while. Let me just make this random thing on one day. I sat in the verdant courtyard that my buildings have and made that. Anyway, so itch, Instagram, and Blue Sky.
Craig, I'm going to need your recording of this. I'm writing down the timestamps of when I froze. I am also getting rid of my Twitter, but you can find me at Blue Sky as well at Joska, or on the internet at Joska, or on Wannabe Games under itch and Drive Through RPG and all of that.
Yay, we're all getting off of Twitter.
Yay.
You can find me at Blue Sky Nerdburger Craig. It's Nerdburger Craig on Instagram as well. My website is nerdburgergames.com, and you can go to drivethroughrpg.com for the games as well. We're starting to count down here a little bit. Nerdburger Games is going to be at PAX Unplugged. So,
me too.
If you're out there, come on by.
Yeah,
I probably won't PAX be there. Unplugged,
and I'm going to be guest of honor at an upcoming international game convention in next year. I can't say which because I haven't signed the paperwork yet. Also, The postman just arrived. Give me one sec.
What did he say?
Somebody's at the door. He may be home alone, so somebody's at the door. The postman.
The post.
my neighbor's very sweet. She's like, there's mail at your door. I'm like, thank you. I'm gonna do that. So that'll be the second time I've been invited to be guest of honor at a game festival. That's kind of cool.
That's very exciting.
Yeah. So when that's finalized, I'll mention it. What was that?
Look at you. More than I've ever gotten asked to do.
No, it was good. It's so funny. In Helsinki, so my keynote talk was on, well, it had a more fancy name, but it was basically about monster fucking. And so You know, like people photograph slides, usually it's a cool quote or like a list of interesting points. There's literally people circulating a photo of me standing in front of a slide that all it says is monster fucking. And I'm like, this is not a very informative slide. And they're like, doesn't matter. I'm like, okay.
Thank you to Avel. Nope. Steph Sex for our opening and closing theme song, which is called Avel, which is licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you, Steph Sex, and thank all of you for listening. And we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye. Man, we really improved all over that outro, didn't
we?
Oh,
yeah, we did.